Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project. My name's Alice and each week I'll introduce you to another brilliant woman who, like me, lives in a gay man's world. This week in a Dorothy Project first, I'm interviewing a bloke. I met Andrew Lumsden on a walking tour of Soho that he was leading with his fellow Gay Liberation Front activist Stuart Feather. On the tour, which I really recommend by the way, it was organised by Queer Tours of London, Andrew talked about a woman called Mary McIntosh and my ears pricked up. Andrew knew Mary really well. She was an activist and academic who made a huge contribution to the rights of gay men here in the UK. In 1968, she published an academic paper arguing that homosexuality is neither a psychiatric nor a medical condition, which was based on her surveys of gay men in Leicester and London. In her time on the Criminal Law Revision Committee, Mary advocated for the lowering of the age of consent for gay men, and she also studied the letters of gay prisoners from the 16th century onwards, observing the 18th century gay subculture of mollies. With her partner, Elizabeth Wilson, Mary was a key player in the London Gay Liberation Front right from the start. She was particularly passionate about making connections between the gay liberation movement, the women's movement, and lesbian movements. So what was the Gay Liberation Front? Well, it was actually a number of activist groups all around the world. Andrew, Stuart, Mary and Elizabeth were in the UK chapter. The original American group was formed immediately after the Stonewall riots in 1969, and the UK group followed a year later. The GLF only existed here for 3 years, but its impact has been huge. The London Lesbian and Gay Switchboard and the activist group Outrage are just two of the organisations which emerged from its ashes. A good place to start would be how you met Mary.
I first met Mary in 1970, and that was at the London School of Economics off Covent Garden, because the Gay Liberation Front had just been launched in London by people who'd been to New York and seen it where it had just started there. And Mary came with her lover, Elizabeth, right at the beginning, very near the beginning.
Was it allied with the Gay Liberation Front in the States, or was it a kind of a completely separate thing taking the same name? Was it like a chapter system?
Two gay men in their early 20s, one of whom was a student at London School of Economics, went to New York to find out what this thing was that people were talking about, the Gay Liberation Front. And they moved on from New York to Philadelphia, where there was a Black Panther convention in September 1970, at which Huey Newton, a Black Panther leader, had sent out messages of welcome to women's liberation and to the just formed Gay Liberation Front. And so delegates went. And Aubrey and Bob, the two from London, were amazed by what they heard and the people they met. And on their way back, they said, we've got to have a version of this in London. And so they talked to a lesbian friend, Beverly Jackson, who was also a student at London School of Economics, and who'd just run for president of the Students' Union under the slogan, Bev the Les for Prez.
It's still got such a ring to it. That feels like a winner to
it's
me.
It's stunning, isn't it?
She win?
I've never asked, which is ridiculous. And they agreed, let's have meetings on Wednesdays. Because they were students at LSE, they booked a room and sent leaflets out, put leaflets out in gay spaces, and people began to come, and then they began to come more and more and more and more. But amongst the earliest of them were two very radical, very experienced feminists, young feminists, of whom one was Mary McIntosh.
So how old was she at that point? Was she an undergraduate, or was she already a graduate?
She wasn't an undergraduate. She was 5 years older than I, and I was then 28, so we're 32, 30. She was 32, 33, looking about 15 or 16. wonderful, brilliant smiles, the most party-going of people, the most committed communist, and, of course, a committed feminist.
Was it a social scene as well, as a sort of working political movement?
Oh, it was very much a social scene as well. Lots of us made friends that last for life. Oddly enough, it was almost like, without meaning it, somebody set up a university for a new gay world, because Gay Liberation Front lasted, in effect, for about 3 years. Some people I know only went there because somebody else said, the men are hot, or the women are hot.
A tale as old as time.
A tale as old as time, but as soon as you were there in the spectacular atmosphere of it, you were either politicised or you... Some were frightened of, this isn't the way I can go or want to go. But thousands came over the 3 years, including from France and from Italy and from all over Britain and from Ireland, of course.
And the types of protests that you did, because I think if you look at it on paper, so much of Mary's work is kind of academic. It was research and then it was reports that were incredibly influential. But there was a bit more rock and roll to the way the Gay Liberation Front operated.
I do remember Mary dragging up as a king on one occasion as part of Gay Liberation Front Street Theatre with a moustache and all. That had been done in music hall and vaudeville in the 19th century, and it existed. But it was not something that anyone who wasn't in the theatre expected to do, so it was a terrific surprise. And for a man of that age, that period, it was one of the most startling visual things I've ever seen, Mary in a moustache. And then she was part of the impetus for going in cooperation with Women's Liberation to make an entire ring of people around the Albert Hall to protest against the then beauty contest that was held every year.
Was that like the Miss World kind of thing?
It was a Miss World event. And women were... It was so shabby. Women were expected to appear in a ball gown at 1 minute, and in a swimming costume at another minute. And if they came anywhere near winning, they were expected to immediately promise to solve malaria around the world and work for peace. And it was awful.
Still exists.
Does it?
It does, yeah.
I had no idea. Where? In some...
Apparently
on it's... On some atoll in...
No, it's one of the biggest entertainment shows of the year in France.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's still, like, sadly alive and kicking.
Oh, maybe everybody needs to go and make a circle around again.
I think so. Yeah, so I'll have to see when the next one is.
Every effort was made to make it clear this was not aimed at any of the women taking part. It was entirely the management's and the profit-making enterprises.
And do you think, like, was it unusual to have that kind of integration between, you know, kind of feminist groups and LGBT groups? And was that something that Mary was really driving?
It was fairly new, and she was so prominent in doing it. There were... I just knew the last generation of immensely misogynistic gay men, and they... Partly it was in them as part of a male culture, as it is in any male. But above all, for that generation that I see more clearly now looking back, it was because they felt bullied by women. They felt bullied by mothers to marry the girl down the street. They felt bullied by sisters, inquisitive sisters. Well, why don't you have a girlfriend? These were men who felt so bullied and put that blame on women that they were vile. I remember things they used to say. So at about the period of Gay Liberation Front came this wonderful, refreshing breeze that blew right the way through all of that. And for those who could be ready to change, I can talk to women. Women are human beings in some way.
Still working on that one. Yeah.
Still working on that one. And Mary was always completely at ease with the gay men and came to love several of them. She and I became very good friends, and not intimate, not deeply close friends, though some gay men, some of my friends did with her, but very good friends. And the last thing she did for me was when we decided about 20 years ago now to put a plaque up at the location of the first Gay Liberation Front demo, which was Highbury Fields in Islington. And Mary gave me one of the Gay Liberation badges that belonged to her at that, because a lover of mine had died very recently and left me some money. And so I paid for this plaque, which was £800. I don't know why it was so expensive, but anyway, it was. And Mary knew that. And she gave me this badge, which I still have. Not because I didn't have one of my own, but
yeah,
as a gift from herself.
Yeah.
And that was the last time we had a long conversation.
And where was the plaque? Do you know if it's still there? Or should I not reveal it? It was stolen. Who made off with that?
I found that very funny. I thought that couldn't have been a more Gay Liberation Front yeah, thing to happen.
Yeah. So whereabouts did you put it?
It was on a public lavatory, which was, I don't know if it's still there, because it's so long since I've been to Highbury Fields.
Oh,
so we had a ceremony and and fun. And
that's the amazing thing, because I lived just off Highbury Fields for like 4 years. So I would have walked past this site of history that I didn't even know all that time. And you say she had this kind of ease with her and kind of the company of gay men. And one thing that struck me about the work that she did at a point where there were so many battles to fight was that she made so many significant contributions, both in kind of helping to lower the age of consent for gay sex,
yes,
and for her work in kind of moving away from a medical model of homosexuality. Like, why do you think she kind of chose those as a focus to her work?
I remember the first time I read the paper she wrote about the medical model of homosexuality, which, if I remember rightly, she decided to publish in America. And therefore, it wasn't something that you found anywhere and everywhere. So you had to get to know through one academic avenue or another, or in my case, through Gay Liberation Front and meeting her, to know about it. And I found it astonishing when I read it, as many years since I have. But she was, in a way, demolishing homosexuality as a term.
Mm.
Useful though it had once been long ago, she was demolishing it in order to open out that glittering road of queer life.
Mm.
And she must have done it. The impetus behind it must have been a combination of affection for people, shone from her all the time, of affection for people represented through her communism, and also because of her high intelligence. The model, this one of an innate medical condition, so don't bully them all because they can't help it, that didn't work for her intellectually. There was something fraudulent about it. And she showed the way for how to rethink.
So her argument, if I've got this right, was much more about that there are much more subtle kind of contexts and different societies will kind of, you know, treat different relationships and ways of living in different ways, and that things are much more kind of, they're much less stable than those fixed categories. Would that be right?
That would be right. And also, I believe now, I wish I could have the conversation with her, I believe now that she perceived, because of her very wide global knowledge through the politics she was involved in, I think she perceived that she was trying to put on one side a Germano-British model, which was wildly out of kilter, even with much of the rest of Europe, let alone the rest of the world. And that model, a German invention, the term homosexual, reluctantly accepted by the British, who are meanwhile attacking everyone, LGBTQI+, everywhere, was so narrow. And those of us who grew up in it thought it was universal. Mary saw it wasn't universal and introduced us to that idea. I found all these concepts so hard, so difficult.
Well, it's a whole, because she wrote as well on the kind of limitations of the family as well. And, you know, if men have to be breadwinners, then that puts women necessarily not as the breadwinner. And it's sort of exploding all of those assumptions that lots of people still make, I guess, about how to live your life as an individual within society. And of course, so she spent time studying at Berkeley in the States.
Yes.
Is that right? And then was sent packing by McCarthyism.
Yes, she was protesting about McCarthyism.
Right.
And I think, I can't remember anymore, but I think she took part in protests on campus. And so they said, you know, out you go.
Yeah.
Immensely to her credit. One thing I think I remember her telling me about was Monique Wittig, who said something on the lines of, there are no women. Women are only a construct necessitated by everybody going on about men. That's the kind of thing that pull the hair up on the back of your neck with Mary McIntosh, because she was merely informing me of something she knew, because I imagine she knew the person. Monique Wittig is no longer with us, but she started Red Dykes in Paris, so she was as much an activist as Mary. All these recategorizations which she worked within without trouble, but which most of us were on a learning curve about.
So one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about was what you mentioned. So we met on one of your queer walking tours of Soho, which was all about the Gay Liberation Front. And you mentioned that Mary had done this work, reading all of the letters sent from prison by men imprisoned for homosexuality, and had identified what is now a fairly well-known kind of subculture in 18th century Britain of mollies who were kind of self-identified gay men. And that's something that's kind of sparked my whole interest in this, you know, hearing about Mother Clapp, the innkeeper who's, you know, inspired plays and books, and I'm just so fascinated, like, what made her kind of go to the archives and search out those letters?
It was Stuart Feather, my great friend from Gay Liberation Front, who first told me about Mary's researches in that. And I believe it was all to do with, I may not be the best person for knowing how the thread went. Elizabeth Wilson would know so well how the academic thread went. But I believe it was her interest in identities.
Right.
That led her to research, well, if this homosexual identity is not a reliable one. What other identities are there? What other ones have there been? And most famously, the one only 200 or so years ago, with everybody believing that LGBT people are straight people who willfully do something that the Bible does not want.
Right. How much of an activist did she continue to be after this kind of early 70s?
Mary never stopped.
Yeah.
But an astonishing thing in Mary McIntosh was her ability to work with organisations like the Home Office. Not, I think, as institutionally poisonous in the 1980s as now, but she could work with the Home Office, and she could work with a university like Essex, which set out, of course, to be a new and innovative university, but even so, by the standards she was accustomed to in her personal life, was struggling to move ahead. But she could work with all these environments where people hardly shared a language with her in order to get something done.
And was that, I'm kind of thinking about my own experience here, do you think that's fairly unusual if, you know, you're someone who is so kind of principled and you come from this activist background to kind of extend that bridge across to these really establishment institutions?
I don't think it's uncommon now at all. Mm. But it was uncommon if you shared the tidal wave of anti-Vietnam War protest, flower power, hippiedom, the rebellion against American conformism was so difficult to undertake in the 1960s that many of those who became involved in it, and Mary at Berkeley did, many became unable to cope with anyone who was straight, just couldn't handle it, couldn't bear it.
Mm.
And Mary was one of those who very early on never lost it, but moved outward into the other area she came across.
Is it interesting? I was reading a history of AIDS activism in the States recently, and it was talking about the split within ACT UP between the group of activists who saw the benefit and were able to work with government and with the drugs companies and sort of were like, there is a greater goal here, we don't like them, but we need to work with them. And then other activists who couldn't do that for whatever reason and were much more at street-based protests and the ZAPs and things like that. So it's really interesting that there's always that kind of tug, I guess.
As long as you can always do both.
Right, and that's the thing, isn't it? A pincer movement is probably going to achieve a lot more.
And some people who can't work with the straight establishments can cooperate with those who can cooperate with the straight establishments. And then Extinction Rebellion is in the middle of this week.
Yeah, and Greta Thunberg in Parliament and speaking to MPs and...
I'm going to Davos.
Yeah.
The gathering of billionaires.
Yes. In their private jets.
And very, very effective.
Yeah.
So it's not that people have to cooperate with those we see as the straight establishment. But Mary was somebody who could do it without losing any self-respect or her voice.
Mm. If you could recommend anyone else for me to speak to, who would it be for this project?
I think I'd recommend, unless you already know, Nettie Pollard and Stuart Feather, both Gay Liberation Front. Ted Brown would be the third person I'd mention. So I'd very happily, if you haven't got them, provide you with the contact details for Stuart and for Nettie Pollard and... And for Ted, we are all in our 70s, and we know people who are much younger, but then you will know them yourself.
No, that would be fabulous. Yeah, I'd love to speak to them. I mean, hands up, who else wishes they were friends with Mary McIntosh? To combine that kind of sense of humour and lightness and stick-on moustaches with absolute intellectual rigour and to see the bigger picture like she seemed to is incredibly rare. Next week, I'm talking to Katia Chirico. Katia programmes all the incredible cabaret we see at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, from Drag Idol to the Chemsex Monologues, as well as her career as a producer at some of the most iconic venues in London, from Madame Jojo's to the Soho Review Bar. Katia is a trained clown and has worked in street theatre and as a stand-up comedian. Don't forget to subscribe so that you've got next week's episode fresh in your podcast app as soon as you wake up next Thursday morning. And in the meantime, please do, if you're enjoying The Dorothy Project, leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts.